You are listening to the Punk News Podcast, episode 285. Hi there, welcome to the Punk News Podcast. My name is Adam White. I'm recording for you here in my basement in Niagara Falls, Ontario. Joining me on the program tonight, out of sunny Los Angeles, Mr. Ricky Frankel.
What's up?
you had some Tom Waits shit going on there.
Yep, did not mean for that to happen.
Yeah, you haven't been hitting the whiskey and the razor blades and gargling rocks and...
No, not my thing.
Speaking of gargling rocks, I don't know if that's a euphemism for anything, but if it is, it's being done by Mr. John Gentile in Philadelphia.
So did Jim play the piano on Friday night? The cold wind would drift through the door out of sight.
What would you consider the stereotypical Tom Waits song?
Oh, you mean what song would be the stereotypical Tom Waits song?
Because I have one that immediately always comes to mind.
You know,
and for me, it's Singapore.
You know, I couldn't say because I people are always like, Tom Waits is so great, Tom Waits is so great. So I got the album that has Cher naked on the cover. Is it Cher? No, Elvira. Elvira naked on the cover. And I listened to it, and it didn't move me to type. I mean, Tom Waits is a unique fellow, and he's got a certain unique talent, but it didn't really move me. So all the songs kind of sounded the same to me.
What record is that?
You know, Loose Change. Isn't that the album Loose Change? It's like he's like in like the back of like a strip club, and like the strippers like across the room from him.
Small Change.
Small Change.
Okay. No, John. You need to go get like a copy of like Rain Dogs and Swordfish Trombones.
I'm open minded. So I should check out those albums.
They're super weird. Like you like things that are super weird. They are super weird. Like especially like Rain Dogs is just like delightfully eccentric. And all the songs sound like they're like drunken pirate shanties. So. Yeah.
I will check it out. I have an open mind when it comes to Tom Waits. My one friend, Tom Garcia, used to tell me how great Tom Waits was. And I was like, well, why is he so great? And he went on and on. And I'm like, what, did the guy buy you a car or something? And he got mad at me and kind of stopped talking to me because I made fun of him for liking Tom Waits so much.
But you see, I consider Singapore the stereotypical Tom Waits song. The Singapore is the first song off of Rain Dogs. Just because, like, it is just, like, weird imagery after weird imagery. And, like he's just, like, listing all of, like, these, like, gutter circus people that are involved as characters in this journey that he's taking. And to me, that is a Tom Waits thing. So, anyways, this is a show. It's called the Punk News Podcast. We talk about what happened in the week of stuff from punknews.org. And sometimes we just talk about... you know, letters people sent us or mail that we're getting or that's the same thing. I meant or records that we've bought. So, we do those things. John, do you have any mail this week?
Oh, I do, but I don't have it pulled up. Give me 2 seconds.
Is it worthwhile? We can ignore it if it's just
we'll push it to next
yelling
week.
At us.
Let's push it till next week.
Good. If you sent us letters, fuck you.
Oh, no, actually, we got some nice. Oh.
Never mind.
This is from David. David says, hi, I want to write in about the David Bowie tribute episode, which I enjoyed a lot. The main point I wanted to weigh on, which was also discussed on a previous episode, was the debate on whether Bowie deserved attention on a punk website or podcast. My answer is yes. Not just because he was a direct influence to so many punk bands, but because outside of his solo career, he was for a while a punk musician. In addition to mixing the Stooges' Raw Power album, he is the person who played on all its piano tracks, and he even played a bigger role on Iggy's solo stuff. You guys mentioned that he was his producer, but he also co-wrote much of his two 1977 solo records and did keys, piano, and backing vocals on those records. He then proceeded to take on his role in a tour with Iggy's live band, as heard on the TVI live album. If someone's definition of punk is so narrow that it doesn't include Raw Power, Lust for Life, or TVI Live, then they can just go ahead and say Bowie has no connection. But if not, naysayers should recognize that he was in the trenches for these iconic songs and albums. Also, one other story that I get a kick out of which wasn't mentioned concerning Bowie's relationship to 77 Punk. A year or so before playing in the Sex Pistols, Steve Jones stole a lot of David Bowie's gear out of Bowie's equipment truck after a show in London. When I look at the mics and amps Steve Jones is using in those early Sex Pistols photos, I always wonder if it is the property of David Bowie. Signed, Dave.
That's quite cool. And actually, there was another connection that popped up right after after Bowie's death, where there's a photograph of like a young, like, I don't know, like 15 or 16 year old Sid Vicious going to a Bowie concert. And he's got this big Bowie t-shirt on with his head on it. And it's like tucked into his like big 70s mom jeans that he's wearing. And he looks like a super dork. And he's, you know, he's the guy wearing the t-shirt of the band that he's going to see to the band's performance, which is adorable. So,
people did it all the time in the 70s. That's a new phenomenon that you shouldn't wear the band's t-shirt to the con. I mean, if you go see AC/DC, everybody's wearing an AC/DC shirt.
I suppose that's true. I don't know. Yeah. Is there a band that it's okay to do that for these days?
Like Iron Maiden?
Metal bands. If you're going to see like Turbo Negro, you should be fucking dressed up in your leather and, you know, patches and stuff. No, you're not. Denim. Yeah.
I do notice at punk shows that it's always people, I'd say, 40s and over, they wear the shirts. To the person that they're seeing, but the kids today don't do that
because it's a new phenomenon. I think it started around the late 80s or early 90s that you shouldn't wear the band's shirt to the band's concert. That's a relatively, and I disagree with that. I think it's totally fine to wear a band's shirt to the band show because you're saying I am a fan. Let us all enjoy this band while we're here.
Support for them. I don't do it though, huh?
Like Ricky, you saw one of the Public Image Limited shows. I don't know about the one you were at, but like the one I was at in Toronto, like it was kind of a weird crowd because like it was all these like old punkers and like 80s new wave people and things that were there. And a lot of them were wearing pill shirts. And then a lot of them were like buying these super expensive pill shirts that they were selling and then just like putting them on right there and wearing them.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we didn't talk about that show, but there were some issues with that I had with that show. Not their performance, but they're just like other details that were kind of aggravating, but it was an older crowd completely. I think I was definitely of the younger people there. I don't think I was the youngest, but I was definitely down there.
Like I felt that I was one of the younger people at the show I was at, and like I'm in my 30s, so
right.
It was definitely kind of fun from that perspective, where I'm just like, well, I'm the weird young kid at the show now instead of the weird old kid at the show. But it was like none of those guys and girls that were at that show, they gave no shits about like modern t-shirt politics. they were doing their thing.
It was all the older people that were either buying it or had their shirts. It's totally cool. I don't think it's a horror. It's not some faux pas. It's some weird insecurity I think that the kids have.
What if is it cool if you wear like a shirt from the 80s to see a concert now? Like what's a band that's still cool? What's a cool band that kids would see that have been around a while?
Bad Religion.
What if you wear a Bad Religion shirt from 1988 to the Bad Religion show? Is that cool?
Depends. Did your dad give it to you, or is it your dad wearing it?
No, it's you wearing it. You're your dad.
I at that show though?
Yeah.
I don't see what's wrong with that. I think it's kind of cool. It's kind of like
if you kept a t-shirt alive somehow for that many years, I guess you have free reign to do whatever you want with it.
Fun fact, did you guys know that vintage t-shirts sell for insane amounts on eBay? Insane amounts.
I've seen this from multiple people.
Oh, actually, there's a Cro-Mag shirt right now. I'm sorry, Adam, I'll let you finish. As we speak, there's a Cro-Mag shirt that's on eBay for at least $1,000. I'm going to look it up right now.
Really?
Yeah.
Like, all right. Like, I have a lot of t-shirts. T-shirt like, you know, Well, I'm sure like probably anyone that is into like punk music from like the 90s onwards, like most of the clothing I've ever owned has been various black band t-shirts. And
that's pretty much my wardrobe.
But like I don't know about you, but like I have shirts that I really love, but I'm not super precious about them. Like they get fucked up over time. I mean, they're t-shirts. They're not, you know, I'm not buying them and like putting them under glass somewhere. So I can't imagine selling any of my, even about like older band t-shirts, because like they're faded and have been washed a million times and have holes in them and all sorts of horrible things have happened to them. So
people don't care.
I think people buy it for that aged look.
Well, I think they buy it as an art. I don't think anybody's wear, like, let me tell you, people, I went, my mom goes to a lot of, what do you call it? A garage sales. And one time she was flipping through the garage sale newspaper and she was reading it out loud and she said, vintage t-shirts. And I'm like, vintage t-shirts? That's a weird thing to advertise. So I drove on down there on the off chance. I got about 6 Red Hot Chili Peppers shirts from 1986 through 1990. And they were beat to hell. And let me tell you guys, I sold them for a lot on eBay. A lot. And I think people are just
saw when you listed those and I was confused.
You saw how much they went for, didn't you?
No, I didn't see how much they went for, but I saw that you owned them and were trying to sell them. And I was like, why does John own all this Red Hot Chili Peppers?
Because I bought them for $3 each. Well, is it bragging if I say how much I sold them for?
No, man, you bought them at a garage sale.
I bought them for $3 each, and I sold them for $600 to Japanese people. All 6 sold to Japanese people.
Holy shit.
What?
$600.
That's insane.
Red Hot Chili Peppers.
I feel like I should just quit my job and go do that.
I think that's like a once-in-a-lifetime score, though. I mean, how often? The reason the guy had them was because he used to work at a venue called the Trocadero in Philadelphia. And he told me he would always buy a t-shirt. I think he really demanded one or ganked one. And so he had all these vintage t-shirts. I got a Red Hot Chili Peppers. I got Soul Asylum t-shirts. I got a Dead Milkmen t-shirt. I got a Yellow Man t-shirt. I kept that one, though. And a whole bunch of like these other like mid to late 80s alt-act t-shirts. And the Red Hot Chili Peppers won for the most on eBay, but the other ones went for a good amount of money too.
Damn.
I'm trying to find this Cro-Mag shirt. Let me see if I can find this shirt. So anyways, if you're out there and you see old vintage punk shirts, they go for insane amounts on eBay. But this is a Cro-Mag shirt. I know I clicked watch it, but I'm just vamping while I find this if you guys want to continue on.
No, I want this awkward silence while we search for things on the internet.
They might have took it off because it was going. You know, sometimes things will go for so much that they make you take it down because they think something wrong is going on.
Was it sold? Did you check the sold listing?
Well, I'm looking. I had it watched. The problem I had when I was selling my Red Hot Chili Peppers T-shirts, though, is I had a bunch of people say, "Let me buy it right now for like $150." And when I first put it up, I got that in like a day or not even. And I'm like, wow. I'm like, if someone's offering me $150 to buy it already, I think I'm just gonna, you know, let it ride and see what happens. And so, anyways, those guys that offered to buy it for $150 that I said no to, they would try to screw me over and like bid it up to $2,000. But I knew it was a fake thing, so I had to actively combat them to beat it down.
Wow.
Oh no, this Cro-Mag shirt. See, this is what happened with the Cro-Mag shirt. It was at $1,000 like earlier this week, but it ended at $152.
So maybe it was a bad bid or something like that.
It was a guy that couldn't get it for the price he wanted to, so he tried to blow it out of the water, which is what happened when I was selling those Red Hot Chili Peppers T-shirts. So this only went for $152, but I've definitely seen like Judge shirts and Bold shirts go for like $500, $800, $1,000. Misfit shirts from back in the day.
Wow.
Shit.
So speaking of buying things, we haven't all got together on the show and talked about record purchases in a while, and we're all here. I assume we all wasted a bunch of money recently.
Oh yes. Yes, we did. It was Ricky's birthday this month.
Oh boy.
Ricky's your birthday every month. I feel like you're always like, it was my birthday, I got records. It was July, it was my birthday, I got records. November, it was my birthday, I got records.
No, just January. So I mean, I don't. If you guys want, you guys go ahead first.
You gotta start like getting the figuring out.
I have
which
my
pages from the dictionary of records that you bought you were going to pull out.
I got to scroll down a little bit further than I thought on Instagram, so hang on a second. Okay.
If anyone on the show is not a follower of Ricky's Instagram feed, it is the thing that makes me super envious. outside of the fact that like that Ricky is young and lives in California, the thing that I am the most envious of is this Instagram feed, because there's just like pictures of all these amazing records that you seemingly either you photograph more frequently than you acquire, or you just seem to acquire six of them a day. So
no. This is so self-indulgent, but anyway, I take pictures of stuff that I've bought already, and then if it just comes in the mail, I'll just say it like just arrived, and that maybe happens maybe like one or two times a month, maybe.
Even the things that like every once in a while you'll post something and I'll be like I'm like, oh my god, I own that, I have to go check if that is the thing that I have. So you posted like a picture of Against Me's Disco Before the Breakdown 7-inch.
Yeah.
And you're like, here we go, first pressing, and it was like the clear red one,
right?
So I'm like, I wonder if mine is the first pressing. And I went and I like dug it up, and like this is a record that I've had from before I collected records. It's just one of these things that I just acquired at one point. So I go and I dig it out of my pile of 7-inches here, and I go and I slide it out of the thing, and it is Pink. And I go and I look up Pink, and it's like 13th pressing. And I'm like, damn it.
No idea. Ricky. Presses Against Me. They're Against Me records like all the time. I mean, I think Reinventing X Roses on its 30-something pressing. But I mean, again, like that first pressing EP, I didn't buy that when it came out. I found that one on eBay about a year or two ago. So that one I've had for a while. But like, something like I'm looking through, for example, I got like the Double Trouble EP from Pill that I really liked. So that came, I think like 3 weeks ago, and I got that. And I think I just said, did that one just arrive? Yeah. I even posted that one had just arrived. So most of my stuff is just from my collection from the 6 or 7 years I've been collecting records. Yeah.
All right. You got that much time spent packed into it. I'm going to at least give you that. So yeah, I went shopping yesterday. I was in the surprisingly balmy and tropical city of Toronto for some business shit. And I got out of that business shit early, and I hopped on a streetcar, and then I went down to Sonic Boom, which is a record store that in its various incarnations has always been like a part of my life. Like it is probably the one that I've gone to the most frequently in anywhere, maybe. And it's a nice store. It's one of these kind of classic Toronto record stores that everyone always talks about. It's either Sonic Boom or Rotate This. But I went in there with a very specific mission, which is that there's a bunch of stuff that I frequently talk about either on Punk News or on this podcast or, you know, in my best of list or anything like that, that are all these like these cool Ontario bands that I like. But I have a really hard time acquiring around here, because even though we have some nice record stores down in my area now, we're Niagara Falls is a little bit of a what's a nice term for this? Cultural wasteland. So while when we do get a good store, it's a good store that's carrying stuff that happens to be from labels that are able to kind of move this stuff, but it doesn't have a lot of stuff from like the super hyper local labels that are around. So like the SRC Vinyl store is here in the Falls now, and it's great, and the people that run it are lovely, but I can go in there and I can find stuff from Fat or No Idea or Asian Man or anything like that way easier than I could find anything from like some random little Toronto label. So this was my chance to go up there and to pick up some of this stuff that I keep talking about, but I haven't been able to get. So I did, wasn't a huge haul here, but it was a very useful haul. Picked up the new LP Basque from the band Hussy, HSY. And I played them on the show a bunch of times. I think I played them on the Best of 2015 show. That record is super vicious and is just delightful in how noisy and crazy it is. So I picked up that, and then a bunch of 7-inches of things that I wanted. So the main ones here being my number one EP of 2015, which was the SARSFest 7-inch from Lids, and that's that band that had members of Metz, Holy Fuck, and the Constantines in it. They had lots of copies of the new Metz 7-inch that has the song Eraser on it that we played on this show a few months ago. I think it's the second pressing of it. It was on white vinyl. Who has it? 3-1-G is putting it out. So anyway, so I found that. And then as I was poking around there, they had a copy of the 7-inch for the Steve Ademic band called Monterey that they released on Hosehead Records a couple years ago. And, you know, if you're a Dirt Nap fan, you've been probably digging all this, you know, cool power pop stuff that the Steve Ademic band's been putting out. And Monterey is one of my favorite things that they put out. So, you know, that was just sitting there for $4. So that became mine. And then I realized that I probably shouldn't just keep buying stuff here. I should go home to my family. So I did. But yes, so that was super successful, picking up all this Ontario stuff that I want to pick up. So I'm gonna leave that. John.
Well, I was down in Baltimore 2 weekends ago, and I've talked about it before. I'm going to talk about it again. I went to Soundgarden down in Baltimore. Fantastic CD store, OK Vinyl store. However, when I got there, and it must have been karma. It must have been kismet. I was thinking about I'm a huge fan of CD singles from the 90s, generally, when they put them out, because they usually put some really rare and obscure tracks on the CD singles in the 90s. And so when I got there, they had this huge bin. It said CD singles, $1. And I'm like, wow, what could be in there? Do you know what was in the $1 CD single bin?
I don't, but I know I love the case that it comes in.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17 Rolling Stones CD singles, my favorite band. And not only that, UK versions, Japan versions, weird, obscure stuff, man. This is really cool. Like, I got, like, their High Wire CD single, which has got some obscure live songs on it, Factory Girl live on it. I got the Ruby Tuesday CD single, which has a different mix of Winning Ugly on it. It's got Ruby Tuesday on it. I got, I got this rare Mick Jagger CD single, which is really cool, because it has him singing this weird blues song on it. And actually,
I'm legitimately surprised that there are Rolling Stones CD singles.
There's lots of them. They put out a ton of them in the late 80s and early 90s. And Adam, you might remember this. Do you remember three-inch CD singles?
Yeah, if you had a computer that had or a car or something that had like a slot loading CD player, you could really fuck them up.
Right. They had a bunch of 3-inch CD singles. I got some to flip too. I got some REM 3-inch CD singles and stuff. But I can't believe that CDs are not cool right now, and I'll tell you, I am reaping the benefits. So, I mean, I literally thought I was in a dream. This is true. I literally thought I was in a dream, because once in a while, I'll have a dream about getting a really good record score. Adam and Ricky, do you ever have those dreams?
I think I had one.
Adam, what, do you ever have a dream like that?
I cannot say recently that I have.
But I literally have dreams where I'm in the record store and I find like a huge stash of like record, and I wake up, I'm like, no, and I'm pulling up these CD singles. I literally got like 40 CD singles. Got a bunch of Paul McCartney ones, and I got some other ones too. And I'm looking around, I'm like, how come no one's taking these? How come no one's and I'm like, I had one of those like supermarket shopping baskets that you carry. It was full of CD singles, and I'm like, how come no one's doing this? How come no one's digging through this? This is a gold mine, a literal gold mine. And I look over, and I see this guy with a scarf and a pea coat and glasses and tight jeans. And
hipster alert.
You will think I'm making this up, but I am not. Do you guys believe what the guy was saying to his friend? I think this is the one I'm going to get. I think this is the record I'm going to get. I'm going to get this record. Do you guys know what record it was?
Lady Gaga on picture disc vinyl.
Nope. Adam White, you know what it is.
Fleetwood Mac?
It was Fleetwood Mac Rumors, new $35 reissue.
What?
I'm not even kidding you. And I'm like, why are you buying that? You know, but it was to my benefit. And man, I was so thrilled. It made my week. It made my month. I was so happy to get these singles while I was down at Soundgarden. I also got two other cool things. I got this rare Alice Cooper 7-inch. It's an Alice Cooper. The kids might not know who Alice Cooper is. Alice Cooper is a very, very, very famous hard rock proto.
You're not explaining who Alice Cooper
is. They knew who Alice Cooper is. I got this really weird. I didn't even know what it was when I saw it. It's a Alice Cooper EP from Muscle of Love. It's a 7-inch single, of course, but it's got four tracks on it. And apparently it was only released for jukebox because apparently for a little while in the 70s there was a fad where jukeboxes would be EPs, not singles, so you would get two songs for a quarter or whatever instead of one song. And so what's cool is it's got its own little blue unique sleeve, and the sleeve actually like folds over like an envelope. So it's just a neat little collector's item. The last thing I got, and we're not going to talk about this guy every week on the podcast, but I would be remiss if I did not talk about this. I got David Bowie's Black Star on vinyl. And let me tell, I mean, like, you know, physical copies are selling less and less. A unintended benefit of that is it seems as though labels are putting more and more effort into making the actual package nice. The David Bowie Black Star record is beautiful. It's one of the coolest looking records I've ever seen. It's got a die cut star on the front. Everything is in black. There's no color on it whatsoever. The entire thing is black. It's black on black writing. The cover is a die cut star, and under the star is the record itself. The record is black and the label is completely black. It's just a beautiful, clever, unique package, and it really does add a certain gravitas and also an artistic aesthetic, a visual artistic aesthetic to the oral music. It's a beautifully well done package. So kudos to the designer of the David Bowie Black Star 12-inch album. And that's what I got.
Cool, Ricky.
Instead of Fleetwood Mac for $35.
He lost out here.
That's true. I'm not making that up. That is really true.
You know, I kind of have a similar story to that. I no one bought this, but I'm seeing now that vinyl's become like a major thing. I'm seeing it pop up in different stores that I feel like it just kind of shouldn't be. And I was at a Guitar Center, and they had a small vinyl section. Ask me how much London Calling was brand new on vinyl.
Probably like $38.
$40.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
You like that skill, Adam White? You like how I nailed it?
And also like Urban Outfitters has it now. Hot Topic has always had it, but like, it's just weird. And I really won't buy from those places. I'd rather just go to like the record stores. Anyway, I'm going back. I'm just scrolling through, probably October-ish, I think, to what I have. It'll be probably one of my usual longer lists. First one I'm going to talk about: F-minus Wake Up Screaming, on black vinyl. Classic hardcore, I would say Brad Logan's first band, I believe, which I actually took to a Rats in the Wall show maybe a month later and had him sign it, which was very cool.
I have a copy of that. I think I just played it the other day, actually.
That's
the one that was on Bridge 9?
No,
Hellcat or even
No, no, those two. You're right. That record was on Hellcat. Sorry, I'm thinking of an F minus single.
A CD single.
No. It's not a CD.
It is. There's a 7-inch version and a CD version. It's like red and it's got the girl's face on the cover.
Yeah, it's what.
Wake up screaming. I'm gonna figure out Wake up screaming.
Was it Wake up screaming?
No, that's the album.
Yeah. So he was cool enough to sign that. Very nice guy. And then I saw the Briggs, and I played a song from this EP and I reviewed it. They put out a self-titled EP, which came on purple vinyl, which is very cool. I just bought that at their merch booth.
For the record, I'm thinking of the Sweating Blood single.
Man, F-minus, like, you want to talk about awesome 7-inch records, F-minus. They really did put out cool 7-inchers.
Overlooked band, I feel.
Yeah, they are overlooked.
Overlooked. For the holidays, my sister was very cool and got me a repressing. Asbestos Records is some record label. I want to say they're on the East Coast. I don't think they are, though. That like repress a lot of older records and like do like really cool things. They did that Against Me's New Wave. But my sister got me for the holidays the Suicide Machines Battle Hymns on half pink, half like opaque pink vinyl, which was cool. I know we kind of took shots at Black Friday Record Store Day, but then like that week I found this on eBay and I just wanted it for the collection. is the 15th anniversary pressing of High Fidelity's original soundtrack, the movie. And it came on like gold, translucent gold vinyls, like a gatefold. They did a really nice job with it. Even Jack Black's Let's Get It On is on there from what he sings in the movie. Then I found, I think this was definitely like November. I got this pack of 7 inches. Basically, it's Fat Music for Riot Fest people too, and it's just three flexies with pairs and strung out split, Good Riddance and Western Addiction split. And then this, I just thought this was so cool because I don't think we'll ever see this again. But there's also a flexi that's a Nightbirds and NOFX split. So I thought that was awesome. So that was just kind of one of the collector's things.
That's rare. Where'd you get that? That's like really rare.
Oh, dude, they're all over eBay and Discogs. Oh,
okay.
Yeah. Then I pre-ordered this like in June and it finally got here, but it's a Scandal Sound of Your Stereo from Say 10, which put out the vinyl version. It came on like this weird pink and white swirl vinyl. And then my family got me different records for my birthday. So like my brother and sister got me like Descendants and Jello Biafra and the Guantanamo School of Medicine. And then on my birthday, on the day of my birthday, I went to two different record stores. I went to Amoeba Hollywood and then to get like some more like plastic sleeves and stuff, I went to CD Trader. I picked up an album. Whenever I would go, I would just put it back because it was always that one album. Like I'm not sure yet, but I finally got it. I got One Man Army's Dead End Stories on clear vinyl. I also got, I think I got Propagandhi's, the 20th anniversary edition of How to Clean Everything and Dillinger 4 versus God. I think I got those three and then that was it. Then I drive down to CD Trader that day thinking I'm just going to get the plastic sleeves because I've already blown too much money as it is. What do I find at CD Trader? I find a first pressing. I'm pretty sure it's a first pressing. I don't know if it's but anyway, it has the pink and yellow cover. Nevermind the Bollocks by the Sex Pistols. French pressing from 1977.
That's cool.
I just had to take it. So I got that. And then I also, this is the only bad transaction I've ever had on Discogs, but I got, like I said before, I got the Double Trouble EP from Pill. Cause it has, that was one of my top 10 EPs of 2015. Cause I thought, the title track is awesome. And, there's also Betty Page is a great song too, which is on it. And, there's also a B-side that didn't make it onto the full length, which was also very cool to hear. So I went down to, just this weekend, I was in the Anaheim Fullerton area and I was told like this, you got to go to this place called, Radiation Records. It's a small record store, but goddamn, do they have like the best punk selection I've ever seen. They somehow beat the Amoeba punk section, but Radiation is just a purely punk record store. It's small, but it's filled with great stuff. There's a small metal section, tons of 7 inches, and I've been getting into this band lately. I'm late, but I've been getting into Mean Jeans, and they had a copy of On Mars, which I took, and then also they have special box, like two cardboard boxes for like the rare stuff. And so I'm going through it. I'm like, oh, this is cool. You know, what was in it? Like a Dead Kennedys German pressing. And
how much was that going for? Like, what are the prices there?
The special stuff, like that German one, I think was like 30. But their prices for a record store were pretty fair. They don't do record store day, which kind of sucks. But you kind of got that vibe that they wouldn't. What else did that have? It's not important, but I did find something I thought that was just so cool. I found a UK version of Fresh Fruit for Rotting Vegetables on white vinyl from 1980. And it, what's really awesome about it, and this is what kind of pushed me over the ledge to get it, 'cause I almost wasn't going to, that red and black and white DK symbol is the label on the back on the B side. And it's just a spectacular piece. And when I posted it, East Bay Ray started following me on Instagram, which was kind of cool. And then today, I got a couple things from Paper and Plastic. I got Brutal Youth's bottoming out 7-inch first pressing on like red splatter and clear vinyl. And then I also got the Shell Corporation's Mandrake on green and like whitish splatter vinyl. So that's about that. That's updated. And I believe that's from like, I'm pretty sure that's like everything I've gotten since like September. So,
Ricky, that feels restrained.
I've been cutting down a little bit just because, you know, I had a mission for a while to get everything that's come out that I've enjoyed on vinyl. So now that stuff is starting to slow down. I've been trying to go for, it's been like a lot of new releases and old releases that I've been wanting to get. And now I am just going for more new releases because I have a lot of the old stuff that I've been looking for.
I appreciate the restraint that you're demonstrating.
Yeah, I can't. I realize like I can't keep doing this forever. So I'm trying
not that you'll go broke, but one day you will be crushed by a pile of records.
But remember, kids, records are a great investment. They will always be as valuable as they are right now. So hold on to your records and don't sell them, kids. It's a great investment.
I'm double. I got a couple that have gone up in value, but, you know, whatever.
No, I mean, honestly, though, like, records are at the height right now. If you have a record that you're keeping for money, sell now. I'm telling you, sell now.
I have a NoFX 7-inch from the Fat Record store that I want to sell it, but at the same time, because it's going for a lot of money, like quadruple what I paid for it, and that's without it being signed. Mine's signed.
And what can I do with all these copies of Death of Superman?
Well, that's exactly it, Adam. What you remember when Death, the white bagged edition of Death of Superman was going for $200. Now you can find it in a 50-cent bin.
Don't buy things to make money off of them, people. I do that
all the time. I flip shit all the time, Adam.
Flipping is one thing. Don't buy them to hoard them that you can then like retire off the pile of NoFX 7-inches that you have one day.
I mean, listen.
I'm saying flipping is fair game. I mean, like, if it's out in the record store,
flip away. Don't hoard.
Flipping's totally fine, but I mean, there's and honestly, I buy this stuff because I enjoy it and I like collecting and I like it's more of a it adds to the hobby. I really enjoy it. So, but I mean, there are those people that are selling their original Misfits 7-inches for like $1,500 or something
Yeah.
So.
Okay. I don't know. So let's play a song from one of these records that we've been talking about here. I'm going to play the title track off the Steve Adamic Band's EP, Monterey. This came out in 2013, I think, on Hosehead Records out of Canada here. So this is Monterey by the Steve Adamic Band. We'll be back in a minute.
Yeah.
are back on the Punk News Podcast. That was a Steve Ademic band out of Ottawa, Ontario. We were just talking about records. There's an interesting story here that has come out. 2015 turns out was the first year in which catalog albums, old music, music that had been prior released and available, outsold new releases. So the catalog records outsold new stuff by 4.3 million copies. This is the first time since Nielsen became tracking sales that this has ever happened. Now, while digital sales of new albums did outpace the digital sale of older albums, when you factor in physical releases along with digital, the old stuff came out on top. If you want to contrast that, back in 2005, new releases outsold old by more than 150 million units. So we're seeing a slight tip of that scale right now. I also want to note, as far as these statistics go, a sale only really factors in actual sales, digital or physical. It does not factor streams because you haven't actually bought anything then. But this is interesting. There's a part of, I think, there's a part of every music person that is going to read a story like this and go like, "Cause that's because modern music is horrible." But I don't know if that's really the most insightful thing to look at here. But what do you think, John? Old stuff outsells new stuff. I have a theory, but what's your read on this?
My theories are several theories congealing. I have one main theory and several supporting theories. I will save my main theory for the last. Here is the first supporting theory. First of all, there's more old music now more than ever. So in 1970, say, there was only, I don't know, 20 years of, quote, old music or 30. I realize they've been doing recorded music since 1890, but records that actually sell on a mass market, that only goes back to the 60s. So in 1970, there was only 10 years of old music. Now there's, what, 60 years of old music, you see. So the ratio of old music to new music is that exists is much more outweighed. Second, the 60s and 70s were kind of the first generation that really defined themselves through their music listening habits. Before then, music listening generally was kind of like a family thing or a group thing. It wasn't a generational thing. I mean, old people and young people used to listen to Frank Sinatra. Old people and young people used to listen to Glenn Miller. Old people did not listen to Jimi Hendrix. Only young people listened to Jimi Hendrix. Now, those young people are older and are sort of reminiscing or trying to get back their old music, and they have a much larger disposable income than they used to. So you see those people, you know, buying all these old records, all these old all these old CDs and reissues because they want to have them again. Third, and this is my main theory, basically the way people listen to music is different between generations. Adam, you and I are kind of the last physical generation, if you will, and that people our age and older, when they buy music or when they consume music, they say, "I will go out and buy this album and listen to it." Now the younger generation is much more of a streaming generation. Buying a record isn't even something they would – buying an album, rather, isn't even something they would necessarily consider. They, if they want to hear music, they stream music. The primary way they get access to music is by streaming. So much like someone might pay for cable, the younger generation would rather pay for a service which gives them access to music rather than actually own a copy of that music, physical or digital. And I think that's the main reason. So what I'm saying is, so older people are buying music that they want, which is generally older music, while younger people aren't buying the music they want, they're streaming it. And I think that's the main cause of why we see this new phenomenon, if you will.
You know, I'm kind of, it's weird for me. I'm kind of stuck in the middle between that physical and streaming thing. Cause I mean, I don't like streaming, but I'm in that transitional generation where, you know, when I was 12 and, you know, 11 and 12, I had my own CD player and that was it.
Did it play 3-inch CDs?
I think so. Anyway, but you know, that's what I used. And then, you know, when I turned like 13 or 14, I got my first iPod, and that's when stuff really started changing. That's when it started changing. So for me, I can kind of go back and forth. But again, I mean, just like I listed off, you know, I like my vinyl. Do you think this happened also because they're reissuing those dumb reissues of like Fleetwood Mac, like that Moron you said it was buying brand new, and the kids are just falling for it?
No, but honestly, I don't think that's much of it. I think more of CD reissues, but also I think just older people buying music in general. Even though people are talking about how vinyl is more popular now than ever, that's true. Vinyl still represents a very, 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 very small slice of the music sale pie. I think it's like 3 or 4%.
Yeah. So, I mean, this was it was interesting, though. I mean, yeah, there's still a lot of new music, but I mean, a lot of old music. And I would wonder like what a pop star's strategy for releasing their music is now. Is it mostly streaming or is it just like all digital? I really wouldn't know. And maybe like they'll do a special vinyl thing for, you know, the diehard fans later on.
I think there is no strategy right now because I think the major labels are still trying to figure out what to do. Because if we look at Adele, she sold like 13 million albums last year, which is insane. The biggest albums generally now only sell about 400,000, 500,000 copies. Adele sold 13 million, and I was very glad to see that.
So, but has the definition of an album changed, though?
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, like, is it like – because, I mean, people, if you go on iTunes, you can pick and choose the songs you want, basically.
When they say album, they mean they bought the whole album.
The whole thing.
14 tracks, 15 tracks or whatever.
That's pretty crazy. That's actually pretty crazy.
So here's the one thing that I think is going to factor into this as well. And this is just part – I think all the other trends that you guys have mentioned are absolutely true. But we're in a phase now where the things that are the top selling albums of these years that we're in, of 2015, are not – selling anywhere near close to what the top selling albums of, you know, 10 or 20 years ago were. But just like there's a much wider base of music that people seem to be purchasing and less concentration up at the top. And at the same point, you know, music is less, it is continually less central to whatever is going on in the culture. So you have people's dollars split where they're spending money on, you know, video games and apps and movies and everything else. And it's not necessarily a record that dominates anything. And so just like as the example here, the top selling record of 2015 was
Adele.
In 2015, Adele's 25 record sold over 5.98 million records. I just went as you guys were talking and just punched in 20 years ago. So 1995. What was the top selling record of 1995?
I'm going to guess it's like Bush.
Hootie and the Blowfish.
Yes. Oh, yeah,
cracked
you're right.
Rear View. Hootie and the Blowfish's Cracked Rear View in 1995 alone moved over 10.5 million units.
Whew.
But I think Adele sold more than that, didn't she?
No, 5.
Oh, she only sold 5 million. Are you sure?
Yeah. 5.98, just close to 6.
Oh, wow. I only want to be with you.
Yeah. So something like Hootie and the Blowfish 20 years ago was selling way more than, say, Adele is selling today. And so just like what you have to do to be number one is half now of what it was. And this year was atypical in that, like, last year, I don't think there was a record that was as big selling as Adele's record was.
No, not even close. Like 1 million was like a huge amount.
Yeah. So this was a bumper crop of records that came out in 2015, apparently. And that isn't even still doing half of what, you know, Hootie and the Blowfish did 20 years ago. So that's, you know, that's something to think about.
Hmm.
I don't even know if we have anything else to say about this, but yeah, there we go. The old stuff has sold way more than new stuff. Speaking of old stuff, Iggy Pop. That was a good seg. I like that.
That was good, Adam. I'll give that a solid A.
Yeah. So there's been a bunch of music that's been coming out from the collaboration that Iggy has done with Queens of the Stone Age's Josh Homme. Is it Homme?
Homme. Josh Homme.
I've heard it so many times, like even on like professional radio people that should know this shit, they don't know how to say it.
Yo, Josh Homme.
I know, like Homme sounds more fun, but I always said it was Homme, but then apparently that wasn't it. Whatever. Josh, the guy from Queens and Stone Age, has been collaborating with Iggy Pop on Iggy's new record. The album is called Post-Pop Depression. There's a couple new songs that have come out. There was a song that was streaming called Gardenia a little while ago, and then there was a performance on Colbert of a new song called Break Into Your Heart, and you can find links to both those things over on Punk News. John, have you been a fan of the modern day Iggy stuff? Like, were you rocking Skull Ring or anything?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, like for me, well, Iggy's at his height in the Stooges. I don't think anyone will argue against that. Iggy at his best is in the Stooges. His first two solo albums are great. I think a lot of, he's got a following for his albums after the first two solo albums, The Idiot and Lust for Life. I think it goes Lust for Life, then The Idiot.
Lust for Life rules.
No, I think it was Idiot and Lust for Life. Yeah, Lust for Life does rule. Honestly, I avoided Lust for Life for years because I thought it was bad. It's not.
It's so good.
It's really good. Anyways, I think a lot of Iggy's post Lust for Life albums are just kind of – doesn't seem like he put a whole lot of effort into them. I think aside from – was it called American Caesar? That album's pretty good. I have not been a fan – I've not been a huge fan of his post Lust for Life work. I'm not a fan of Queens of the Stone Age. I think they're a boring rock band trying to reconjure the spirit of 70s, you know, hard rock, you know, the Stooges, Alice Cooper, MC5, and they just kind of fall off as dull and unoriginal. And I wanted to hate this. I didn't hate it. I actually thought it was kind of good. It reminded me of Bowie's work with Iggy Pop, especially The Idiot. I find it interesting how Iggy generally now, like on his solo stuff, he doesn't do the mad dog running around on the stage like in the Stooges. He does kind of the more artistic, cold, you know, weathered stage person with an air of what's the word I'm looking for? A dignity and an air of being wise, whatever that word is when someone's wise.
Wisdom.
Which I don't have. And so I thought it was actually pretty good. It reminded me of his work with Bowie. I think it's pretty good. What I was going to say is – oh, but what this really underscores is a lot of bands that are big fans of the Stooges, they kind of just try to redo the Stooges, and you can't redo the Stooges. And they take the wildness or the energy or the raw power of the Stooges without any of the intelligence. And if anything, I think this release underscores that even though Iggy is the wild man, even though he is crazy, even though he is the cheetah, the lizard, he's an extremely artistic fellow that is interested in what we would call high art or classical art. And I think he conveys that through this record. So I'll even though I'm anti Josh Homme or anti Josh Homme, I'll check this out.
I didn't like this. I thought this was very Iggy has done slow songs before. I thought this was very slow and very calculated and very it seemed like he was sort of on a leash on this one. I think Josh Homme's holding him back.
You think he wants to be Josh Homme's dog is what you're saying?
Not in the way that he says it in that song. But it's just very – I think Iggy's being kind of held back. I think he can be doing better on his own. If you watch the Stephen Colbert performance, Iggy's even wearing, you know, a collared shirt. You don't make Iggy wear shirts. You never do that. He didn't even wear one when he was on Marc Maron's podcast. Which happened a few weeks ago, I think.
You think someone put a shirt on Iggy Pop? Like, he didn't make that choice like an adult that he was going to wear a shirt that day?
I would not be surprised if NBC asked him.
I don't think – honestly, Ricky, I don't think anybody tells Iggy Pop what to do. Like, there's a quote by Henry Rollins, "A cheetah doesn't know he has spots," and I think that's true with Iggy Pop. I think Iggy Pop is just constantly in motion, and he just does what he wants to do. And he can because he's Iggy Pop, you know?
Well, regardless, I wasn't digging this too much. In terms of the post, those two solo albums he had, I think 5 Foot One's a good song. There are some songs you can pick and choose from the later albums, but yeah, again, not a fan. Not like in a hatred way. I just don't think this is. It was just kind of bland. It really wasn't that great. I think you could definitely hear the Queens in the Stone Age thing kind of popping through, and I just wasn't digging it.
See, I actually like Queens of the Stone Age.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, I like their first two records quite a bit. I really like
the one with the red bulb one cover.
With Nick Gulliveri and Dave Grohl on it. Shit, come on, The one after Rated R.
It's got like a pitchfork on it or something.
Yeah, what was it called?
I don't know, Queens of the Stone Age 2?
Fuck. Songs for the Deaf. I like that record. There's a lot of cool songs on that stuff. After that, less and less kind of going on just because I kind of got bored with them. But I don't have any hate for the guy. He seems to do his thing. I was not quite sure about this collaboration just strictly going off the Gardenia song, but seeing the performance of it here, I kind of dig what they're trying to do. And yeah, it is, I think a more restrained and maybe a more Bowie-ish version of Iggy that's coming through, but he's, you know, so long as no one's like, you know, beating him down to be that way. If that's the vibe that he's trying to do right now, he can pull it off. So I'm cool with that. I'm interested to hear this whole thing. I think the whole record is probably going to be like this. It's going to be a fairly subdued version of Iggy Pop that comes out on this thing.
Well, I mean, that title pretty much gives that away.
Yeah, the title absolutely gives it away, right?
How low is Iggy's voice these days? It's almost inaudible. It's so bassy. What's beyond bass? Baritone? What's below baritone? Bass. Bass is below baritone. His voice is sub bass. Like, I can't believe. I mean, his voice. He's always had a low voice, but his voice is so low now. It's amazing. I don't know how he talks.
Well, I say that's what I think is kind of interesting here, because like I don't feel like anyone's really taken the last few Iggy Pop releases with any degree of seriousness. So if he's going to go do, you know, like if this is to become the Rick Rubin working with Johnny Cash phase of Iggy Pop's career, that could be interesting. We could get some interesting stuff out of that.
I wish Iggy Pop would record with Rick Rubin, but not Rick Rubin now. Rick Rubin 2002.
Should we talk about Rick Rubin too much? I feel like that's the kind of thing that's going to get you stabbed.
Rick Rubin?
Yeah.
We're going to talk about something later on that might get me stabbed. But
there's so many minefields we have to walk through that may or may not get you stabbed. I'm never sure which way to go about them. Pop has released a new song. It's called DVP. It is going to be on whatever the record that they release next is. So that record is expected some point this year on Royal Mountain Records and Side One Dummy Records, depending on which country you happen to be living in. It follows up the 2014, self-titled. Really 2013 released full-length Pup that everyone got on board with and really loved. So there's a song. It's called DVP. You can check it out. Ricky, what'd you think of the sucker?
I actually have a story about this, believe it or not. They have actually been playing this song for close to a year now. And I know this because I saw them do it. I saw them summer 2013 at the Roxy in Hollywood. And it was a mind-blowing show because, first of all, it was a great lineup. It was a weird lineup, and I'll tell you why. First, I think, was Cayetana. Then it was Pup. No, I'm sorry. It was Lemuria. Then it was, I get those bands confused all the time. It was either Cayetana or Lemuria first. Then, you know what? Sorry, I'm gonna start over because
it was probably Cayetana.
It was Cayetana first. Then it was Pup. Then it was Lemuria. Then it was the Menzingers. While they were doing, I think they had just released On the Impossible Past like that year, I think, or maybe it was a year after. I forget. But Pup was like the new band that was like blowing up. And, you know, they did Reservoir, Mabu, and Guilt Trip. And then they blast into this song and it blew my fucking mind. I thought this was, and I'm like, oh my God, this is amazing. And you can see videos of them playing it on YouTube because I went to check it out later. But I loved it. This is definitely one of my most anticipated records of the year. I'm really interested to see where they go because their first album was so. It was very dynamic, and they had so many different sounds going on for each song. I mean, like if you compare, I'll just use Reservoir and like Yukon. Those are two extremely different songs. One's basically a blues song. The other one's a high power punk song. And yeah, but what happened was Pup should definitely have gone second to last right before the Menzingers, because they blew those other two bands out of the water. Those are two pretty softer bands, but Pup just decimated the crowd. I mean, everyone was totally thrilled. They loved him. So yeah, I'm very excited for the new Pup album. That's about it. I love the first thing. I think this band can really do no wrong. And if you can look online, they do a spectacular cover of Sabotage by the Beastie Boys. John, what'd you think?
I think I got to hand this over to Adam White. I know Pup is his band. Adam White was down with the Pup when they were still Topanga. I remember Adam White played a Topanga track on the Punk News podcast. He was like, this band is great. They should be huge. And sure enough, Adam White was right.
Adam White is always right. My wife actually told me I have to stop talking in the third person when I talk to my kid. Because it's going to screw them up. I'm into this. I mean, I had a little bit of trepidation about what Pup was going to do, only because they had such a burst of kind of goodwill and positivity that I feel that like I went through 10 years of seeing bands do that and then, you know,
throw it
sign
all
to a major and release a pop album. I I know that's not the way the world works anymore, but there's like a part of me that has some like PTSD to that. And I just think that's what's going to happen every time the new song comes out from someone. But no, this is cool. I'm actually surprised how fast and fun and shouty this is as a song, because it defies all of those expectations that I just set about, you know, what you're supposed to do when you mature and have a big fan base and stuff like that. So that's cool. We'll have to wait and see what the rest of this record sounds like. Perhaps this is a swerve and everything else on here sounds like whatever the popular band du jour is. I don't even know what I'm comparing them to, but I'm good. I like this. I have to give points to the person in the Punk News comments section who commented, does this song take a really long time to go anywhere? Because that's what the DVP does. And
what is the DVP, Adam?
That's super funny to me. The DVP is the Don Valley Parkway. It's the highway that borders the one side of Toronto. It is one of, well, really four highways that surrounds Toronto, each of which is horrible in their own special way. The DVP is not one that I have a particular beef with because it is not on the Adam side of Toronto, so I am rarely on it. But I know that a lot of people that live in Toronto and that have to commute from here to there, they really hate it. I personally hate the 401 far more, but you know, hey, to each their own. But I thought that was very funny and I wanted to make a big deal about it on Punk News. And I thought, you know what? No one cares about like Ontario geography and location jokes other than me. So I'll just leave that alone. But anyways, new Pup. Ricky, play us a song here.
All right. So I'm playing a song from a band we've been sort of covering lately at Punk News. They're called Decent Criminal. Believe it or not, their guitarist is in another band that I played a song on the podcast a while back. They were called M Section. Very cool, fast, no effects, the agnostic front kind of band. But now, and that was their guitarist, Brian Gelman's other band. He's now, I guess, doing this, focusing on this a lot more. They kind of got this like surf punk vibe, I think, and garage vibe. I think if you were into like the Toy Guitar album last year, maybe, Antarctica Vespucci possibly, and Jeff Rosenstock's We Cool. I think that this kind of falls in around there. I think these guys have a little bit more power behind them, kind of more of a kick and an edge. But they released a new video called Binge, which you can check out on Punk News. And they'll be going on a small West Coast tour, but I think the album's really good. I need to give it more of a listen, but for review, but I'm gonna play one of the more punk rockish songs on this album called Soar. So this is Soar by Decent Criminal.
That was Decent Criminal. We're back on the Punk News Podcast. Ricky, I'm going to leave this with you because one of your favorite bands has a new record coming out.
Yeah, this is hands down my most anticipated album of the year. I am so stoked to say that Pairs' sophomore album has been announced. It's called Green Star and it'll be released April 1st, 2016 on Fat Records. Green Star is the follow-up to their debut full-length Go to Prison and will feature re-recorded versions of the amazing songs Snowflake and Anhedonia from their Letters to Meemaw 7-inch. And you can read more about it on the Punk News article. But what Zach Quinn says in this thing is to me, blows my mind. Their lead singer, he says, the biggest difference was Go to Prison was a fast thing. We just threw that together. This, we slaved over it. We wrote songs and cut parts of songs and put them into other songs. It was a nightmare, but I've never been more proud of anything. Even though it was a completely different process, it still feels like the next step. I am so excited for this. Pairs Pairs have exploded faster, I think, than Pup did. The fact that I had been pushing them on Punk News for maybe 6 months and then they get signed to Fat, to me, just the whole thing blows my mind just how fast this band has exploded. Are you guys Pairs fans? I've been pushing this stuff pretty hard. I mean, what did you like the Letters to Meemaw 7-inch that came out, I think, like in August? What about Go to Prison? What do you guys think of this? I have a feeling this is going to be huge, I think.
I liked Letters to Meemaw. I liked Go to Prison. Neither of them are records that have stuck with me after I heard them. And I remember my impression when I was listening to them was that, like, in a good way, the band was sort of all over the place, but they were lacking something that was going to sink in and hook whatever part of my brain is looking for a hook there, which isn't really a slight on the band. It's more just a, you know, that was not, it did not it was a square peg that didn't fit the round hole that I had in my brain at the moment. So I have nothing but, you know, well wishes for Pears. And I'm actually really excited to hear what this record sounds like, because I have a feeling that they're going to start to fall into that focus that maybe I was looking for from them. But
I think we'll definitely, at least compared to, just judging by the album art, I think what we'll see is a much more, I think, more mature recording and more mature writing, I think.
Yeah, you know, compared to the other release, I wonder if they're going to pair this with any other media, or they're going to pare down their tracks, or, I mean...
John, what are you doing?
Are you
this, show is, this show is over an hour long and you're making stupid jokes here.
Are you a Pears fan, John? I feel like I'm the only one talking about them.
I like Pears. I don't love Pears. I'll be very interested to see what they do for this release. As for any band, the second release is always the hardest release. And generally the way it works is your first album kind of establishes your core theme. For a lot of bands, the second album is where they kind of fumble. And the third is where they either recover with a large grandiose statement or fade away. So we'll see what happens. Although some bands, second album is always the hardest album for a band, I would say. So it'll be, do you just, the question with the second album is, do you just redo the first album, or do you do something radically different? Do you completely change your sound, or do you try to evolve from it? Look at The Clash. They kind of had a little bit of trouble with their second album. Let's look at The Damned. They had a lot of trouble with their second album. Let's look at some newer bands. Bands that had like a dynamite start and had problems after that. None are coming to mind, because not a whole lot of bands make it to second albums these days. Classics of Love. So we'll see. I like Pears. I think this is going to be the one where they really make a break. Masked Intruder, kind of. Their second album wasn't terrible, but it did not garner the reaction that the first album did. So we'll see how they. It'll be the real test. But also, even if they do fumble, and they might not, is there's always the third album. That's the true test, album number three.
Hmm.
I mean, I think that's apparent.
You see, where I see Pears maybe as far as being a fat band is I'm thinking of them almost like the Flatliners. In that the first few releases that the Flatliners put out on Fat were, you know, it was carrying on the sound that they had pre-Fat. It was hinting at kind of what they were going to do and what they were going to become, but it wasn't quite fully baked yet. It wasn't quite where it had to be yet. But then they came out with something like Cavalcade, and it was just like, well, holy fuck, like, where has this band been? Like, you know, they were okay, they were fun, but all of a sudden they're insanely good. And I feel that like Pears is a band with that kind of potential. And generally, bands don't end up on Fat that don't have that kind of potential, because, you know, I truly think that they have a pretty good ear over there for that kind of thing. So that's why I'm looking forward to this more than, you know, more than I would given how their earlier stuff didn't quite stick with me.
Hmm. So I'm stoked. This will be a must pre-order for me.
So speaking of things that are young and vibrant and full of newness in life, Harley Flanagan. John, I'm just going to give this to you.
Well, Harley Flanagan put out his new album on Friday. It's called Cro-Mags. Of course, as you know, Harley Flanagan was a part of the Cro-Mags, but he got kicked out or quit or who knows. There's two main Cro-Mags, John Joseph and Harley Flanagan, and they hate each other. People think the Replacements hate each other or Husker Du hate each other. Husker Du and the Replacements never literally stabbed each other and got arrested. So these two guys hate each other. The critical problem – well, not the critical issue with the Cro-Mags is Age of Quarrel is one of the greatest albums ever made. It is an amazing album, but they never quite recaptured the magic after Age of Quarrel. Harley Flanagan's new album, it is unquestionably, in my opinion, the best – post Age of Quarrel, Cro-Mags related album. Not as good as Age of Quarrel, because it doesn't quite have that gravitas. I've used that word twice now. That inherent, I guess, mystic outward look on life as filtered through a street level person that John Joseph has. But the actual music is slams. One of Harley Flanagan's biggest issues sometimes, he gets a little too medley sometimes. But on the new album, it's 24 minutes. It's 12 tracks. Every song is about how he hates somebody, and it just rips. If you like Age of Quarrel, if you like the Cro-Mags, check out the album. It's great. What can I say? It goes to show that Hardy Flanagan, as I've stated before, is a master composer and is a true genius when it comes to recording music. Will he and John Joseph ever get back together? Probably not. It's sad, but at least we've got this album. So this album is about as good as you can hope from a non-true Cro-Mags album.
John, I feel like you've been on like a media blitz for this album over this week. Like,
Only because the album came out on Friday, and I had the interview scheduled for Monday, and they released a track on Monday. So I did my review on the day of the album release. And then on Monday, I posted the release of the single and that my interview. So, it has to seem as though I've been on a media blitz, but I mean, that's kind of how it works when an album comes out, you know. I will say is that, well, no, I'm not going to go there. But, I mean, that's just how, you know, album cycles work, I think. And also, though, part of it is I really was surprised at how good it was. I didn't think it was going to be that great, but it really was. I mean, I'm not bullshitting you. If you like the Cro-Mags, you will like this album. It is a great hardcore punk record.
Yeah, that's the song that we posted is mean, it is fast, it is.
Oh yeah, what did you think of it? I mean, what did you think of the song? Honestly, like, what did it say to you? The song.
I am by no means like a Cro-Mags scholar, at least compared to the degree that you have emerged as their champion over the past while. So while I'm familiar with Age of Quarrel, I'm totally not familiar with a lot of, you know, the all the post.
Honestly, you don't need to be. I mean, it's. What can I'm being honest. The post Age of Quarrel albums are. I mean, if you love Cro-Mags, they're worth checking out. But unless you're a big fan like me, Age of Quarrel is all you need.
But I like hearing a song from someone that is like a bona fide veteran like this, and then hearing it just rip and be mean and angry and lively and not you know. Like, say what you will, but it's not tired, right? And
yeah,
that's
yeah.
You know, I always like hearing the old guys prove that, like, you know, that by is no means punk rock a young man's game. Anyone can do it, right? So I like that.
Ricky, any opinion?
I also thought it was good. Is that him? Is he's singing, right? Is it?
He is singing. Yes, he's singing. Okay, he's singing and playing bass and maybe guitar.
You know, I am a casual Cro-Mags fan enough to where I saw them about a year ago, and it was hands down the most violent show I've ever been to.
Ah, but that Hardy Flanagan was not there, mind you.
No, he wasn't. It was
John Joseph.
It was John Joseph and talking about how great Vice was when they interviewed him. What I found interesting, because I didn't get this. I mean, people were not only ragging on him on the on this video story, but also the your interview. People were ragging on Harley, and I don't get it. He seems like someone I would take seriously as an artist and as someone that would break my face.
Well, I would agree. I think you nailed it in that Harley. A lot people ragging on him are the kind of people that like mid tempo music, you know. But Hardy Flanagan is a complete. He's a maniac. He is a maniac. I mean, you. He's a maniac, but he's a great artist. You don't make art that is this nasty, this wild, but this clever without being a complete maniac, unless you're a really rarefied individual. But pretty much anyone that makes completely off-the-wall, berserk music like this is a maniac. And so people making fun of him because he is a maniac, I guess, but I appreciate the fact that he's a maniac because that's what allows him to make this kind of music. I mean, honestly, normal people generally don't make mind-blowing music. Sometimes they do, but usually it's true weirdos that make the best music, at least in my opinion.
Yeah, that show still.
And he's a badass. Like, people are. Hardy Flanagan will kick your ass, you know?
So yeah, like.
I think people are threatened by that, or they're scared by that, or they're made to feel inadequate by that because Hardy Flanagan. You know, people talk about bands, they're like, oh, so and so's a good guy. I'm not going to say Hardy Flanagan is not a good guy, but he's a maniac. He's not the kind of guy that's going to come up to you and be like, hey, man, thanks for buying my record. He's the kind of guy that if you say something bad about him, he will kick your ass. You know what I mean?
So. Yeah, I mean.
I interviewed Harley, and I didn't know if he and I would get along, but we did. So, I mean, there's a lot of conflict between him and John Joseph. I like them both. I think they're both great artists. and I got along with them both, but I am aware of the fact that they're both maniacs.
All right, John, this has been a long show. Are you playing a song?
Yeah, let's wrap this up. Listen, I'll be quick. Mischief Brew, one of my all-time favorite bands, they just released a compilation. It's called Bacchanal in Philadelphia. It is essentially a compilation of what is basically their first two releases. It's not really their first two releases, but it's almost their first two releases. One side is their release from, I think it's 2003, from Bellingham and Philadelphia split. It's the Mischief Brew side. The other side is their first official EP called Bacchanal. And it's remastered. It's out on Fistolo Records and Square of Opposition Records. And they did a wonderful job, you know, kind of cleaning up the sound, punching it up. It sounds great. This is Roll Me Through the Grates of Hell by Mischief Brew off their new compilation, Bacchanal in Philadelphia, out on Fistolo Records. Roll Me Through the Gates of Hell.
I am a leader, but you will not follow me. I ain't no preacher, for I'm full of blasphemy. See you in hell. Dancing with some devils. I'm a bad girl with a hope for a better day. My laughter is spiced with mischief. I won't toss salt, kiss it up, or pray. When you offer pink or blue, I'll take the blackest. When you offer only two, I'll offer three. When you point me in a direction, I'll run backwards. And at the border of utopia, I'll toast to anarchy. 'Cause fire and rock, I'm coming home to you. Well, I'm picking the bones out of my dinner stew. Open up the gates of hell and roll me through. Fire and rock, I'm coming home to you. I am a leader, but you will not follow me. I ain't no preacher, for I'm full of blasphemy. See you in hell, boy. So you're saying Satan's army's rising up soon? Well, if it is, I'm the Secretary of No State. Got wrenches, rocks, and bottles in my tool pouch. My desire is society's jailbait. 'Cause there's tons of guys moping about the workday. Dimes by the dozens, their song weighs 1,000 pounds. But there's nothing like a lady with a buzzsaw. I just might build your house, but I just might tear it down. 'Cause fire and rock, I'm coming home to you. Well, I'm picking the bones out of my dinner stew. Open up the gates of hell and roll me through. Fire and rock, I'm coming home to you. I am a leader, but you will not follow me. I ain't no preacher, for I'm full of blasphemy. See you in hell, boy. Your rebel children. There ain't no use in locking doors. There's one of me in every home. With mud on my boots and blood on my jeans, I'll take those pretty dresses, tear them at the seams. Roll me through the gates of hell, ah, please. And I'll be back in your daughter's dreams. I am a leader, but you will not follow me. I ain't no preacher, for I'm full of blasphemy. See you in hell, boys. See you in hell. See you in hell, boys. See you in hell. See you in hell, boys.
All right, we're back. This was the Punk News Podcast. If anyone wants to email us, it is podcast@punknews.org. We will be back in a week. See you guys later.